Do you know when you think of her, does your dad live in the same place that he lived years ago?
Yeah, my dad, born and raised, Kalispell, Montana. And that's where I grew up too. Did, you know, all my school, high school, then moved out in the Midwest to do college. But yeah, and Bob Allison,
What was the town like that you grew up in?
I want to say it was, when I grew up there, it was a pretty small town. 10,000-15,000 people, maybe. Mm. Beautiful northwest corner of the Rocky Mountains, really close to Glacier Park, which is a big, like, national park destination for a lot of people in the U.S. Mountainous. Grew up in a valley, so big mountains, big, like, you know, cinematic mountain
ranges. Just looks amazing, yeah.
Wherever you look, you know, like,
Wow.
Very similar to, like, Colorado, same mountain range.
Is there any mountain lions?
Yeah.
Did you have mountain lions?
Oh, for sure.
Seriously?
Oh, yeah. Mountain lions, grizzly. Yeah. I mean, we're right. Like, all that stuff. All that classic stuff. But when I grew up there, I took it totally for granted. I was like, ugh, mountains. Who cares? You know, because, like, as you do as an entitled child, learning to see the world. And then when I came to the Midwest, there's no mountains. And sometimes I would see there'd be a storm or something, and I'd see the clouds on the horizon, and I would think, oh, mountains. And then, oh, no, not mountains.
do you wish that, like, do you appreciate it now when you go back?
Oh, of course. I mean, it's so lovely. Yeah. You can take a train too. There's a great train service called Amtrak that, I don't know, it's debatable on how great it is, but the ride through, you go through the Midwest, and then there's a line that runs up through Glacier Park, and it is, I mean, Scott, I'm talking like train bridges, like, you know, those huge with stilts that go down 100 feet into the river, you know.
Glacier Park.
Oh, yeah. Look, Glacier Park.
And how close
I love how you say glacier.
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 Is it glacier?
Dude, I'm working on, P.S. sidebar, I'm working on an accent because I think that we need to do a video where we swap.
Oh, I could do that. The problem with...
So you got to... Yeah. You got to start working on your American...
The American thing's so hard, though, because you've all got these, like, really... Like, mine's your... I'm not even sure what my accent is. I think it's just a bizarre mix.
I'm working on it, dude. I'm gonna try to unveil it at some point.
Have you got a Montana accent?
Well, I don't... Definitely people don't think of Montana as being like a place with an accent. Check it out. Accents. There's this one. Midwest, where I live now.
Yeah.
The typical rural accent here is kind of this. Okay. So maybe if we're going to talk about, SBL. Have you joined up SBL there, bud?
Yeah.
It's a little, like, it kind of leans into the nose a little bit there, bud.
Yeah.
And it almost kind of Canadian, but we don't do the boat. There's none of the boat.
A boot.
It's still kind of, It's still about, there's that kind of thing, but it kind of is this. And then you kind of dip down south, right? And then it kind of goes a little bit back and everything gets a little bit lazier.
Yeah.
So then this is kind of the southern, but there's all kinds of variety of the southern thing too. I'm maybe doing kind of more of a slow thing right now. This kind of feels maybe more like, maybe a little more like Texas. and then the other one that I love, there's one, and no one in California thinks they have it, but California kind of has like a thing where everybody's like, oh yeah, all right, yeah, like it kind of just lives a little bit more in this like laid back space, and you kind of put your vowels at the back of your throat a little bit, and it's like,
so interesting.
Fucking A right, man. Yeah,
that is so interesting how you can do that. It's amazing.
So when I, you know, when I'm alone, I try to do you, and I'm gonna
I want to do one day that you're gonna absolutely nail it where we flip.
Yeah, dude, I'm gonna show up with the glove, and then people are really gonna be confused, man. People are really gonna, they're not gonna know. I'm really not going to know. I just got to get on the Peloton, man, and start eating a little better. I gotta drop a couple of LBs, you know what I'm saying?
Dude, I need to. Right now. My wife is on it at the minute. She, honestly, she's on it. She's like, not on the Peloton, but she's like hammering the running machine every single morning. Like, and she's been.
Oh, does she really?
Yeah, she's been doing it 6 days a week for 7 months. I'm just like, my
that's
guilt,
incredible.
My guilt is just getting, yeah, because like I used to be the fit one of the family. I was like she's just like leaving me in the, I'm smoked. She's like, just left behind. What? I never saw it coming either. She was just not into it at all. And now she's just on it. It's amazing as well. She's feeling great for it as well. So.
Oh, that's so cool.
Yeah.
That's very similar. My wife rides the Peloton every day. She has not missed a day since we got the bike. So it's, I feel like it's maybe been like a year or something crazy like that.
Seriously?
Where she hasn't missed a day. And then I started out real strong and I'm like, yeah. And then now I'm the biggest slug.
Well, you were put off, weren't you? For anybody listening, Ian's got a Peloton bike, but he was put off because you went on the shop one, didn't you? So you had yours, yes. Didn't you? You had your Peloton, and then you went on the one in the shop to do your 100th ride. Is that correct? And then the one in the shop was
well, not
easier.
My 100th ride.
Yes. Your 10th ride.
My like 28th ride. Yeah. Yeah, that's probably, to be fair, yes. But my wife, we went in to do her 100th ride, right?
Yeah.
So you can go into the shop. And I got on the bike, and the numbers being the same, you crank up resistance with a knob, right? And it was so easy, and I'm crushing these big output numbers. So they do this number called output, which is the combination of your cadence rotation and the resistance, right? And then you get this output number. And mine was bigger than I'd ever seen at home. And I got done with the ride, and they're kind of going like, oh, wow. And I got a personal record, Scott, a PR.
Yeah.
And then everyone in the store is going, oh, congratulations on the PR. And here's some juice. And here's some, and I said, but... And it was the bike was calibrated so much easier than the one we had at home. Yeah. And then, of course, you go look it up, and yes, this is a thing. And so it killed all the competition for me of like, oh, well, now my old man and I, old Bob Allison, who we're going to visit, he's riding a bike too, and he has these giant numbers, and I cannot help but think that his bike is just easy.
I know. It's like next week when you get on holiday at your dad's place, the first thing that you're going to be doing, yeah, dad, get out of my way. I'm getting on the Peloton. Get out of my way.
Exactly. That's what I'm going to do. Oh, man. So, but okay, you should just be competing against yourself. it's still a great workout. It's awesome, but.
Do it. Yeah. I'm gonna get one. What are we talking
are you
about
really?
Today? I'm definitely gonna get one.
Okay,
sure.
Good. Yeah. When you get one, I'm getting back on the bike, Divine.
Don't do that.
We'll go
don't
for
put,
it.
Don't put your guilt in mind. Like, oh, I didn't get back on because Divine never got one. Don't shove your guilt on me.
I love it. That's what it's going to take to get me back on the bike.
We're in the early 40s. Oh. We've got to do it. What we're going to talk about today? What's the topic?
What do you want to talk about today?
Should we just have we done anything about gear? Should we talk about the bases that we love and why? Let's just go full gear nerd because I've been like geeking out all. I was going to say all week, but honestly, kind of sort of like just a confessional. I am just obsessed. With bass gear, dude. With basses specifically. Not so much amps, not so much effects. I am like an addict when it comes to basses. It's like I'll wake up in the night, I'll look on my phone.
Are you on Reverb all the time?
Reverb, like TalkBase, basschat.co.uk.
Basschat in the UK.
Yeah, just like I'm just an addict. It's out of control, actually. And it does fluctuate. It fluctuates up and down, has done for the last 20 years. But I'm always using. I'm always using, but it fluctuates.
I really actually appreciate how you put that into like addict terminology.
It's out of control.
It is so true. I am the same. I'm sure we have different gear acquisition goals.
Yeah.
But there is not a day that I don't check Talkbase classifieds.
Yeah.
And Reverb for specific things. Now, I might have a different... Oh, I'm so excited for this. I'd love to hear from you, like, what you're going after right now. Because, obviously, you can... You've got a bunch of stuff. You have access to a lot of things. But what are the things right now that are, like, super hot on your list? What are the things that you feel like you got to have that you haven't played? Like, I want to know, like, where your mind's at right now.
Man, it's just such a mess in there. It's just, it's like, it's panic. It's like...
So you don't have, like, a goal. Like, this year, I'm going to find a great Fodera. Or this year, I'm going to find a great Rickenbacker. You're just casting out into the sea comes something.
Imagine this. This is what it's like.
Yeah. Okay?
An 8-week-old puppy. Okay. Yeah. An 8-week-old puppy and he's in a room and you put it and there's like loads of bowls of dog food everywhere and toys and yes. 2 toys. And then you just let him go. Just imagine, like, if you've seen he's just going to run around like a maniac, shoving his face in the food. There's food flying everywhere. There's chew toys going everywhere. It's a massacre. That is what my brain is like. Sometimes there's a thread of kind of just like purpose behind it, but a lot of the time it's just manic. I've got no idea why.
Oh, that's amazing.
It's probably it's like the only area of my life that's like this. It's quite bizarre, but anyway, so right now it's like it's old jazz basses.
Old jazz basses.
Yeah, because I've not anywhere between kind of like 60 and probably mid-70s. It kind of like fluctuates between those. And they're very different instruments, actually, which is interesting.
They are very different.
They're very different. But that is what I'm kind of like, you know, kind of looking for at the minute. But it fluctuates.
Do you like buy one, check it out, then if you don't like it, do you send it back? Are you able to try some of these things? I mean... Dude, do I have thoughts about jazz basses? I mean, can I just say that I've got big thoughts for you about 60s and 70s era jazz basses? Like, what have you tried? What have you liked? What have you tried and not liked? You have anything at the moment that you want to show us, Scott Devine?
I haven't really got. So I've got like P bass. I've got like a farm of P basses.
Yes,
I've got.
Yes.
So I've got an interesting thing to let you know about the P bass. Actually, we'll delve into that in just a few minutes. It's it's an odd one. It's a bit of a bizarre P bass kind of confessional. But with the jazz basses, nothing really. I've got like PJs, but really nothing with like J bass pickups. And I have played. The problem with ordering stuff online is that you're ordering it just because of the way it looks. Like, fundamentally, of course. Does it look cool? Is it attractive to me? I'm going to buy it. And I had this really interesting situation a couple of years ago where I went to a bass shop, and I was going to a bass shop to record a comparison video. It was like, we're going to do sort of like a comparison video of like 20 or 30 basses. And I was just going to...
I've seen that video. Seen of it, course. Right?
So yes. I looked on their website before I went and did that video, and they had like 4 or 5 jazz basses in. One of them looked incredible. It was just so tasty. And the other ones, they're okay.
Sure.
So I went down. And we were recording the video, and I actually didn't record on this particular bass. I recorded on the one that looked nice for the video. I can't remember what it was, but it was like late 70s jazz or something. I can't remember. And then randomly I'm sitting there, and there's like these 3 or 4 other jazz basses. I'm like picking them up and trying them and talking to the videographers while we're there. And I picked up one, and it was just insane. And you would not have bought this thing if it was, you know, on reverb.com. It didn't look anything special. It was insane. It was the best jazz bass I've ever played, period. And
Tell me why it was the best jazz bass you've ever played, period.
It played like a dream. So it played like a dream. Like all old jazz basses, it had like, you know, notes that didn't work, stuff that was wrong with it, all of that stuff, right? Big chunks at the back of the neck, all of that stuff. But it played like a dream. And when the nut wasn't too thin. Like on some of the jazz mm-hmm. basses, that you get the really thin nuts. The nut wasn't too thin. Neck felt great. The setup was beautiful. It responded really well. Do you know what I mean about yeah. responded? When you when you dig in a little bit on the plucking hand, the note kind of opened up how you want it to.
Jumped out.
Yeah, the notes yeah. opened up and jumped out. They weren't like too dead. It wasn't too right. buzzy. It was just sort of like they opened up perfectly. It was the perfect jazz bass. I played it for literally 15 seconds. I turned to Mark, the guy who runs the shop, and I was like, I have to buy this bass. And he said, it's already sold. Oh
my God.
Oh, come on. Dude, that's killing
devastating.
Me. It was devastating. And there was these.
I got goosebumps, yeah. Scott. I got goosebumps over my arms right now. It's devastating.
I've got the goosebumps on my shoulders. There was these sexy looking jazz basses. This was just a plain looking, I think it was a 70s actually, a plain looking early 70s yep. jazz bass.
Yeah.
It was bonkers. It was incredible. It was one of the
natural. Was it natural like with a white pickguard?
It was natural with a black pickguard.
Black pickguard.
Natural with a black pickguard. And I think it actually had the four bolt neck. Is that early 70s?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah.
That would be I think they went to that. Well, they got away from four bolt in the mid to late 70s, maybe even like 76 is when they did bullet truss rod and yeah. the micro tilt and the three bolt. Because I have a 78 that's three bolt. Yeah, so it would have been, pre-76 for you.
Is your cool. jazz bass, is that like, did you have a similar experience in that you picked it up and you were just like, this is incredible? Or is it just like one of them yeah. basses that you learned
right.
to love over time?
Well, I'm trying to see where it is right now. So, okay, here, check this out.
For anybody wondering, this is the Desert Island bass for Ian. If his house yeah. is burning down, this is the bass he's grabbing.
I think that's probably right. I have so this is my 78 Antigua. Yeah. And then I also have a really beat up Sunburst 68. Mm. 68 is in a different spot. Maybe it's downstairs. That's always flats. I use that for a lot of the synth stuff, but this one is rounds, and I love it. I've played the hell out of it. I've done all this wear on it myself,
Yeah.
The quick story on this is that I fell in love with this color.
Dude, the Antigua is the best color they've ever done. I don't care what anybody says.
You know what, Scott Devine? I'm glad to hear you say that, because I have a thing about Antigua, yeah. that if you don't like it, I don't trust you.
Exactly.
Yeah. If someone is like, oh, gross, I immediately question your taste about everything. but as gear addicts do, we fall in love with a color and we fall in love with an idea of the instrument before the instrument arrives, right? I found this on eBay. I bought this bass in 2004, I think. Mm. I found it on eBay. I ended up hitting up the guy because they're so hard to find. And I said, I just want to buy this from you. I don't want to play the auction. Would you sell it to me for a price? And then we got to chatting and check it out. He's also from Montana.
Get out.
He grew up in this little town. Yes. And he went, this is incredible. His name's Marty. He went to my great grandmother's preschool.
No way.
Yeah, man. Amazing. And he knew some people in my family. And so we had this really great connection. He said, you're the one for this bass. You got to have it. We agreed on a price. Then he said, get this. He goes, here's the deal. You just have to be the high bidder so that I can cancel, so that I can end the auction. So if you wouldn't mind, we can even do it together. Get on eBay, be the high bidder. Once you are,
yeah.
So we did. I start bidding and it's going up and up and up. And now we hit my price.
Yeah.
I'm still being outbid because there's someone that's put in a higher bid, right?
No.
And he's like, oh, it's okay. He goes, it's okay. I'll still sell it to you for what I agreed on. Keep going. And I was like, it just started to feel weird. And then I went and I went and I went and it got up about $600 higher than we agreed on. And then I was finally the high bidder and he canceled it. And I said, oh, Marty, I don't know. And he said, no, it's fine. I'll still sell it to you. And then he goes, oh, and everyone, if everyone listening, I don't recommend this, but he goes, oh, hey, here's the deal though. I don't do PayPal. Can you send me a check?
Oh.
Oh, no. And because I'm an addict, he was like my dealer and he had the perfect drug. He had the perfect drug, Scott. And so I said,
yeah, man, what's your address?
And he gave it to me, and I wrote him a personal check, and I put it in the mail, and I crossed my freaking fingers, and nice. Guess what, man? Marty came through. The thing, so it was a happy ending, no drama. He sent me the bass. We still keep in touch, man.
Wow.
Like, I'll still send him photos and videos, and he's, oh, man, he's a great dude. Anyway, what I want to say about late 70s jazz basses, and probably all jazz basses actually, is that they are really imperfect. Like, I got this. Yeah. It's so heavy. It has huge neck pocket gaps. Mm-hmm. The pickups are kind of weak and weird. But I just learned how to play a jazz bass and how to hear a jazz bass with this one.
Yeah.
So I've tried to beat it with a bunch of other things. Like, I have a black custom shop here that I never play. Like, empirically, it's better in every way. It's lighter. The pickups are nicer. It has more low end, more output. But I always come back to this one. Yeah. So I'd even love to know your thoughts about that stuff, too, of like, you get used to something, and then you kind of want to run with that.
I've never played.
Right? And then you try to beat it.
I think that, like, I've never played a bass, an old bass. I've never played a new bass and had that same, I suppose, instant, tonight, goose pimples. Mm. Like, this is amazing. Yeah. I've never, ever played a brand new bass and had that, where I've played a few secondhand ones and had that, yeah. And interestingly, like, I'm going to butcher it a little bit, but Ken Smith wrote, he used to have a forum. In fact, I think it's still around. Ken Smith had a forum, and I can't remember what the question was, but his answer was, he said, look, old instruments sound better than new ones. I'm never going to make a new Ken Smith bass that will sound like an old one. The old ones will always sound bad. And then he went into kind of like a description of why. I can't remember what that was.
Sure.
But man, if the dude who is making the bass and he's selling the bass is saying, yeah, I cannot make a bass that sounds as good as one of the old ones, there's something there.
Right.
Like, I'm not exactly sure what it is. Magic, you know, myth. I'm not sure. But there's definitely something there. And I've never
Something there. Yeah, and I find, I don't know about you, but I find that it's not necessarily like that the old ones are quote-unquote better. They're just different. Mm-hmm. There's something that makes you kind of go, oh, and my 68, which I'll bust out maybe on another episode, but that one is the beat-up Sunburst one. That's one that I found in St. Paul, which is across the river from Minneapolis here, in a shop. At the time I was playing Lakeland basses.
Yeah.
And a guy said, oh, Ian, you gotta check that out. I looked and it was all beat up and I thought, oh, that looks cool, but nah, you know, I'm not into that. And I played a G. I'll never forget. I plugged it in, played a G, and it was just like, like, it just played the most perfect sounding G.
Yeah.
And it just sat and felt good and honest, and I just melted. And I don't know, man. I mean, it's real cool. But then when you A-B compare it against new stuff, it's quieter. It's like, I don't know, it doesn't sound as special. But like in the hands, the way it plays, the way the neck's broken in, all those things factor into this.
Yeah,
like,
man,
love.
I think it's the player experience. It's the player experience. I think it's actually...
It is.
To hear it in the mix of a song, I'm not quite sure that I'd be able to do that in the stuff that I'm talking about. Like, it's definitely sort of like something that just feels kind of different. And I think that, well, you know, Yamaha, I think it's to do with the resonance of the wood, and I'm not exactly sure about the science of it, but Yamaha actually tried to recreate that aging of the wood. I can't remember how they did it, but there was some kind of, they put the wood and it was like literally shaken or something for weeks.
Yes, I remember
that. Shake the bodies for weeks.
Yeah.
Didn't MTD
maybe do that as well? I thought MTD had some kind of aging machine I can't remember what it was, but yes, I've heard about this as well, that the idea is that the wood, over time being vibrated,
sort of
takes this different molecular shape.
Exactly. That's it, isn't it? Yeah. I'm just, aging. I wonder if it'll come up on Google.
Yeah. So these manufacturers are throwing their bodies and necks in the aging machine and trying to get them to open up and, you know, get that vintage mojo.
Yeah. Because Yamaha, is this it? No, that's not it. Like, essentially, they've Oh, this is it. Yamaha's acoustic resonance enhancement. Acoustic resonance enhancement. Is this what it's... Oh, maybe.
Yeah, maybe.
It's something like that. And it was Yamaha that was doing it. And, like, I guess, like, something's going on. You know, the science of it, something's going on. Like, it definitely exists. I've never played a new instrument and played it, and it's had the resonance of an old instrument straight off the bat.
Yeah, I know. I know what you mean. I have an upright. I'm dismal at it, but I do play it for some things. And I have a violinist friend who's incredible, plays in this ensemble in New York called Ethel. They're amazing. And he talks about when you get a new acoustic instrument, what violinists will do is just play like flat five double stops, ugly double stops, loud with a bow chromatically up the instrument. And he said what it does is all the like crazy vibration of those, of that flat five interval rubbing against itself all over will start to like unlock the top of the wood. So he said the best thing you can do in classical music world, the best thing you can do to make your instrument sound better is to play things that make it resonate unevenly.
Got
so
it.
That like it doesn't build up certain resonance in certain spots, so that you open up that wood all over the instrument by playing flat fives all over it. I always think about that. I mean, obviously, you know, this stuff is so it's so subjective. There's real science behind, like, if you play flat fives for an hour a day on your like, it will tangibly increase the, you know, there's but I love the idea that, you know, that you can make your instrument sound better by playing it, you know? And I think that that is the thing, right? They sound different and better because of how long they've been vibrated.
There's something going on, dude. There's something going on.
Something going on.
Yeah, there's something going on. That day that was down in, it was called, the shop was called Bass Direct. When I played that jazz bass, he also had five string Ken Smith in there. Oh, that was good as well. In a completely different way, but damn.
Of course.
That was really nice as well. Really nice.
Can I admit something to you? I have never, well, for a long time, I haven't wanted a Ken Smith. I did when I was really young. But then after you got the one with the frog on it, I started to just take a peek at reverb every now and again. And dude, I almost pulled the trigger on a six. I used to play. I know this about me.
I love it. Like,
yes,
I was
dude.
Just going to dip my tiptoe in the water. And then I nearly got a six. It's like and as far like, as you can go.
Like it was like in my cart. I'm like, what am I doing? It was like $6,000. I'm like, I've got to stop. But yeah, man, I mean, I had a Carvin six string and then a Modulus six string for years. There was a time in my like teenage years, like up through my
OT LeBurge,
like, early 20s. Yeah, dude. Oh yeah. I was way into ARU, like Aquarium Rescue Unit and O'Teal. And I mean, I was listening to Michael Manring and I was playing up on that high C string. There's not a lot of people that know that about me, actually. But I was way, and I also loved Dream Theater, So Me Young, and working that stuff out. But there, I will get a six string again.
Dude, like,
it's a confession.
I'm into it.
I am too. And I'd love it to be a Ken Smith, actually. I think I would love that. Do you love your four string?
I love it. I've got it right here. Let's show the people. This is definitely the best bar.
Ugh.
If anybody can hear something crazy in the background, there's a guy outside my window with a strimmer, strimming the...
What's a strimmer?
Like a strim in the bush. Like, can you hear that? It's like a thing. What do you guys call it?
A strimmer in the UK?
Yeah, strimmer.
Well, we just call it probably the brand. We call it a weed whacker.
A weed whacker?
That sounds preposterous. But yes, dude. That's what we call it, a weed whacker.
I'm just going to check this. Strimmer.
I've never heard the word strimmer in my life.
Yes, strimmer. Never. Strimmer, that is, it's a grass strimmer.
Yeah. Like, but is it a trimmer? No, you're putting an S in front of the T, right? Yes. You're saying strimmer. Am I right?
Yeah. I'm actually a weed whacker. What is a weed whacker? Okay, yes. Yeah,
weed
same
whacker,
thing.
Dude.
Yeah.
Same weed. Thing. Yeah,
weed whacker. Who knew? Well, next time in the States, I'll know not to go to any shop and ask for a strimmer.
They will have no idea. Dude, I love that. Just when I think, like, I've worked for you now for a while, just when I think I have a handle on all the differences, nope, strimmer comes out. Dude, I've never heard that.
Oh, there'll be weirder ones than that, dude. There'll be weirder ones.
I know there will.
But, dude.
Show us that bass.
This Ken Smith, man, is definitely my best buy ever, like, of like secondhand basses. I'm looking around, I've got a really cool Yamaha BB, but obviously you're going to be able to pick up secondhand Yamaha BBs.
Although harder to find now because you love them, you big jerk.
Yeah.
Driving that market up.
I know, that's funny. But I've got, I'm looking at them.
Yes.
Like, yeah, this is like the my secondhand buy of my life. You know, this, it was like a early 80s Ken Smith built by Vinnie Federa, and it's hand carved, and it just feels great. Like, it's got, it really does. It's got it sounds nothing like a P bass. And when I think of bass, I kind of hear P bass in my mind. I'm sure that you know what I'm talking about. You know, I just hear it.
I do.
And the Ken Smiths have got a real odd, like, it's kind of one of those love hate bass sounds, and it's something to do with high mids have got sort of like a clucky kind of sound to it, and it's why when you hear it in a mix, it just sounds like it does. If you, and a great example of this actually is Teardrop by Massive Attack. That bass Winston Blissett playing bass, and they do like a live, I think it's on the live version, but it might be on the recorded version, and the bass just sounds like Ken Smith. Just like, because, well, there was so many Smiths back in the day, wasn't there? They took over.
Yes.
They literally took over music for a good few years. But it's definitely got that. And it's one of those tones where if I don't play it a lot, I love it. But if I play it too much, that mid, that top of the mid there just kind of like annoys me a little bit. Kind of like fretless.
Yeah.
If I play too much fretless, it kind of does the same thing to me. Like, I love it.
Starts to,
like,
grate on you a little bit?
A little bit. I'm just like, wah. You know?
Oh, that's...
Yeah. Like, because I'm not like
you. Like, you start to mock it. You're like, oh, wah, wah, wah,
fretless. Yeah, exactly this, right? So there's a huge difference between me and you. Obviously, you know, we're bass players, we're bald, and we're the same age and all of that good stuff. But here's the big difference, right? I am, even though I've got, like, too many basses, I'm a one bass guy. I can't, like, pick up these basses and stuff like that. I've been thinking about this ever since, like, a few weeks ago. You were like, oh, I'm just like, I pick up this bass to get this sound on a pick. I was like, damn, why can't I do that? I was thinking about it. It's because of my pathway through learning this instrument. I'm like a huge fan of, like, my kind of bass guys, right, were Gary Willis, Alain Caron, Scully Svenson, like, all of these guys who had one instrument. So that has impacted my, you know, my subconscious and my psychology around basses. So I've got this weird thing that I don't even understand, but I'm like, oh, I'm a one bass guy. So I will pick up a bass and I'll just play that for a month or 2 months or however long it is. And then back in the day, like... Man, back in the day, I had a 4-string fretless. I played that thing for 3 or 4 years. I didn't have a fretted bass. I did every single gig, theater gigs. I could
fretless.
Oh, on a fretless. I could play that thing and nobody knew it was a fretless. I got so good at it. Sure. I was just sort of like.
Sure. Yeah.
And that's all I played was fretless. I did like Elvis gigs on a fretless.
on a fretless. Incredible. Incredible.
And that's kind of sort of like watered down to now where I've got sort of like, I've definitely got, I don't know, like too many basses. But interestingly, even when I've got too many basses, I still gravitate to just one and just play that one bass. So I really want to strip back what I've got at the minute.
Right. I have noticed over the years watching your content that you have seasons with basses. Mm. Remember the Nate Mendel P bass? Oh, I mean, I remember when you were playing that thing all the time and I was going, man, weird. Like, Divine's playing that Nate, the Foo Fighters bass.
Yeah.
But it's great. And I know, dude, I think about this all the time because there is something about the players that you grew up loving, playing a certain instrument where you think, ah, you want that. You want to be able to put them in a box. Mm. Like, I think about this with Corey, like Corey Wong. He's a Strat guy. That's part of his branding.
Yeah.
At home, he's got other guitars. There's videos of him playing a big jazz box stuff before he was Corey Wong, right? Yeah. But imagine now if he came out and he was playing a Tele. It would be weird.
Yeah.
Right?
It becomes
because
part
he's
of
a self-proclaimed
brand.
Strat guy. Yeah. Yeah. Yes. And not that too many people would care, but there'd be a lot of players that would notice. And I always thought too, you know, the crazy thing is, remember when Geddy Lee was always either a Rickenbacker or a jazz bass, and he had, you know, played some weird stuff in the 80s, right? Yeah. But then always playing those iconic instruments. And then near the end of Rush's tenure, he got bass obsessed and started to buy all these things. And then he had them all out on the road on the last tour. So every tune he was switching.
Yeah.
He was playing a Thunderbird on a tune. And then he was playing a Gibson EBO.
Yeah.
And the crazy thing is this. It all sounded the same.
That is so
no
funny,
matter
it?
What
just sounded like
bass he played, it sounded like him. It was indistinguishable. If you closed your eyes and said, what's he playing? You'd go, a jazz bass? And then you'd open your eyes and it would be a freaking, you
EBO
know, some weird Gibson. Yes. Yeah. And you're like, what? Yeah. And it all the way his hand hit the bass. And dude, I will say too, you have a very similar thing where, like, if I close my eyes, I'd be like, that's probably a P bass. Now I can tell with the Ken Smith, but you have like a right hand attack of like when you're digging in and getting a bass to open up and speak, you have a sound. Right? And that sound goes across everything that you play.
It's so weird, isn't it?
Yeah.
Well, yes, I suppose
it's just bonkers.
It's so cool, though. It's so cool. It is very cool. Like, I noticed that about the great, like, players and musicians that I play with all sound the same no matter what they play.
Yeah.
If you're really good, I feel like you kind of, your brain then is going to tell your hands how to get your sound.
Yeah.
Or even when you plug into an amp, you're going to turn those knobs until your brain is satisfied, right?
Yeah.
I have a guitar player friend who played in Soul Asylum and plays in all these great bands, and he'll do this complete rig overhaul where he'll change amps, pedals, you know, cables, the guitar, pickups, everything is different. Yeah. And he plugs in and plays, and it sounds identical.
So I have the same thing about you in that Antigua jazz bass. Every time you could play any bass, and in my mind, if I close my eyes, I'd be like, that's the jazz bass.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So weird. And I had a great experience, actually. Like the guy that kind of got me to play or interested in picking up the bass was a guy called Skúli Sverrisson, an Icelandic guy.
Yeah.
He played with Alan Holdsworth, and he did a bass
Such
solo
a bass.
On Low Levels, High Stakes. I can't remember what the album was, but that was the track Low Levels, High Stakes. Anybody listening should go listen to that right now. Just drop everything. Go listen to it. It's amazing.
Yeah.
But that bass that he used on that, it was just phenomenal. It was a Curbo six-string. Curbo, remember?
Oh, Greg? Sure.
Yeah, Curbo six-string.
Of course.
And anyway, so like years later, I ended up at Skúli's place. So I'm at Skúli's place. The bass is there. I'm like, oh. I picked it up. It sounded nothing like him. It just sounded like me. I was like, no. And it was that. It was a huge moment. I was like, oh, I get it now. You know, it's actually nothing to do with this bass. It's just to do with how he plays.
And how he has, how his brain and hands have adapted to this instrument, right? Dude, I had a very similar thing. I got to interview, I worked at my college radio station in the late 90s, and I got to interview Victor Wooten, who came to play at a club in Minneapolis.
Yeah.
And he had his Fodera behind him the whole time we were doing the interval. I'm just sneaking glances, man, at his cool 80s Fodera, the one with the Kaler, you know, with the trem and from the Super Technique Space video, whatever. And at the end, I just said, Victor, I'm a bass player. And he immediately knew. He was like, oh, do you want to check out the Fodera? And I was like, yes, is that? And he was like, oh, no problem, yeah. And he was so not precious with it. It was just, it was actually, that alone was really inspiring to me. I was always like, you know, to other people, like, keep your greasy mitts off my bass, man.
Yeah,
you know,
but
he was like, no, man, they're meant to be.
Care.
And I was ready to have this transcendent experience with Victor Wooten's bass. Dude, and it was like, it was good, but it was just okay.
Yeah, just a bass. Like,
it was just a bass.
Yeah.
It was a Fodera, but it wasn't set up. It was like higher than I anticipated. Like the setup was like a little bit like beefier than I was like, oh. And like the string balance was totally different than I thought it would be. And it was like so awkward. It was weird, and I thought, yeah. Oh, I wouldn't buy this in a shop. Yeah.
Do you know Hadrian and Farrow? It was
Victor Wooten's bass.
Do you know Hadrian Farrow, right? He's probably like the fastest bass player on the planet. Yeah. I don't want to say just the fastest. He's probably, in terms of improvisation, he's like probably, you know, one of the most, if not the most advanced bass player on the planet, right? Well, I've played his bass a few different times. The action is not low. It's not.
Really?
It's not low. It's not low. It's bonkers. Like, you just expect it to be just like almost glued.
Just laying.
Yeah, just laying on top of the fingerboard. Yeah. It is not low. It was higher than mine. I don't have a high action. I mean, a low action. His action was higher than mine. I was like, wow. Oh. He's just physically a mutant, you know? It's just like.
Right.
In the best way possible. Do you know what you were talking about with Corey Wong, though, in the Strat? What I wanted to do, and I mentioned it earlier, my history with P basses. This is,
yes, please.
It's just worth mentioning, and it's interesting for up and coming players as well. I think, like, I'm not sure what's interesting about it, but I think just putting it out there into the world will be, you know, get people, like, some people thinking about it. When I was starting SBL, so just before I started SBL, I'm trying to remember the bass. I had like a 5-string active bass. I think I had a signature Overwater thing with a high C. Yep.
I remember that bass.
So it was like E to C and that whole thing. In fact, remembering now, I actually recorded my first few videos on that bass.
Yeah, so, I know. I've watched them.
Yes.
I love it.
Oh, okay. So I got going with SBL, and the first few videos, I'm either playing a kind of E to C style instrument, solo style instrument, or I'm playing, I think, like a jazz bass or something like that. Mm. At the same time, there was like a few different dudes trying to do online bass lessons, and they were sort of
course.
Like, and there was a whole E to C thing going on. Everybody, you know, it was like Tony Gray, Yannick Guisdala, Chris Tarry, who was like B to G, but still, it was that thing, right?
Yeah.
And I just sat there one day and thought, I'm just in the same mix. I'm just the same. And all of these guys are amazing. I was like, so I can either try and just be a crappy version of them, or I'm going to have to come at this from a different angle. And the day after, I bought a P bass. And here's the truth. I used to hate the tone of a P bass. The reason I actually started playing P bass, there's two things happen. First, I had that thought. I was like, I just need to like differentiate myself so much that there's no comparison ever.
Yes.
I mean, they're not comparing us because I'm not, they're just amazing. These guys are just like phenomenal. They can just like improvise for 10 hours without even one bead of sweat, you know, I can't compete with that.
Yes, right.
So how do I just not compete with that? And that's when I got the P bass. So there was that sort of like idea, and then also the Pino thing. I like heard Pino play, and I was like, well, maybe P basses are cool. I was like, P basses are completely different to what anybody else is playing. I'm gonna get a P bass. I bought the P bass, and then a guy that was working with me at the time, he was like, you've bought a P bass? Because it was the P bass thing wasn't really big at the time. Pino was doing that thing, but nobody else was really playing P basses. And that's why I started playing P basses. It was nothing to do with I loved P basses. It was like, I just need to be different to everybody else. And that's
why I started playing a P bass. I have goosebumps. That is super inspirational to me. I have to tell you, too, because I was checking out YouTube and all those guys, right? I mean, I've been following Yannick forever. I've been following you forever. And when you started to play P bass, I mean, I don't necessarily remember like the day where the shift happened or whatever.
Yeah.
But what I can tell you is that I immediately noticed, oh, here is a guy that is from that kind of like fusion jazz school, but is not playing the like the typical
bass.
Yes. Yeah. And it was really, and it was, it made me curious and it made me interested and it made me think that you were cooler. Do you know
exactly
what I'm saying?
That, yeah.
Like it made me think, I was like, oh, he's getting it done on like, you know, he's working harder. It's not this fancy thing with all the electronics that, you know, and with the super low action. Like he's playing flats on a P and talking about melodic minor. This is insane.
Exactly.
And it was super hip.
Well, that's why I did it. It was all engineered. It was all engineered. So here's the weird thing.
That's incredible.
It was all engineered. The only reason I used to love them high C's. The only reason that I got the P bass was to really differentiate what I was doing. So people didn't put me in with that same bulk of all the other guys that were trying to do it because they were just so good and I couldn't compete. I don't want to compete. I just want to do my own thing. So I got the P bass and it was just on a whim at the time. I didn't really know what was going to happen. And just to point out as well, and nobody was doing it at the time. Like now there's a lot of really fantastic uber bass players that play P basses. Like the first guy that jumps to mind is for Nick Campbell. Do you know what I mean? Like,
of course.
He's bonkers. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like, and there's a lot of guys that are doing it. But yeah, so it was all born out of trying to differentiate myself. And I think that, you know, like I differentiated myself for reasons to do with like online education and kind of, you know, separate myself from the herd, as it were. But there's also, you know, for all musicians, we can think about how other people perceive us and like what gigs we might get from that. And I know it's a strange thing to say.
It's really true.
Yeah, I've had great conversations with, I'm not going to mention his name, but I had a great conversation with this guy who everybody who listens to this podcast is going to know, right? He's phenomenal. Yes. He's like in the percent of a percent of a percent, right? Same as Hadrian, total mutant. And
I just want to know who it is.
And the guy was really struggling to get gigs. And he was like, I've been pigeonholed. He said, I play this type of bass. I play this type of music. I just don't get calls for any of these other gigs. And he was really frustrated by that, and rightly so as well, because he could absolutely do the gigs, he can do the, you know, he could do the sessions, and he can do the soundtracks, you know, the film dates and stuff like that. He could do all that. He lives out in LA. He doesn't get the calls because of
the association with maybe I have guesses who it is. I won't say though. But the association with the instrument, the association with the style of music that he plays, that he's maybe more of a soloist, right? That he's not getting the calls to do the meat and potatoes.
Exactly
things.
That. Yeah, exactly that.
I have a question for you. When you decided to take that turn aesthetically, so this was really a thing about aesthetics. Mm-hmm. You said, I want to differentiate myself from the pack. I'm going to play a P bass.
Yeah.
And then was it a conscious decision? Like you forced yourself to fall in love with that sound? Because dude, I also hated the P bass growing up.
Oh, that's interesting.
Hated it.
Yeah.
And then,
Worst tone ever.
Exactly. That's really the way I felt because I came up listening to different kinds of music. Yeah. And now, of course, I have an appreciation for it. I play it a bunch on all kinds of different things, but I had to learn how to love it. But it seems to me like when you play a P bass, you did really embrace it. It transferred from being an aesthetic choice to really being one of an authentic tone thing for you too.
It's totally
you
changed
love
my
a
playing.
P bass.
It's totally changed my playing.
I was gonna like, or else you're the best actor in the world because when you pick up a P and play it, I'm like, oh, that sounds like Scott. And so you made this choice aesthetically, but then you ended up falling in love with that sound.
Yeah,
right.
Absolutely. Yeah, fell in love with the sound. Fell in love with the. I can't remember what the. I think I got that custom shop. To begin with, maybe. I'm not sure. But
the white one. Yeah, the white, the red, white, and blue one.
I think so, yeah. That's got an action like a dog on it. Anyway, side note. But it was definitely, I can remember getting it. I got the bass and I just went full Pino. I can remember just learning all of Pino's lines, all of the John Mayer stuff, which was really fantastic.
Yeah.
And the reason why is because for me, that was a critical part of learning how to play that instrument. Because I'm like, a jazz bass is a different instrument to a P bass. A P bass is a different instrument to a Ken Smith. A Ken Smith is a different instrument. They're all kind of different. Like, because they're different sonically, you kind of end up playing them differently. So I really had to learn how to play the P bass. I didn't know how to play the P bass. So I learned a lot of John Mayer lines and I went really heavy into James Jameson as well, because he's obviously, of course, you know, learning how to play that stuff was kind of sort of like a key thing. And then obviously I played anyway, so all of my kind of stuff got mixed in there, and then that ended up who I am now as a player. But it definitely completely changed the way that I approach playing, and also like what I love in an instrument. So for me, I really like P basses. Like this Alinto down here has got a 44 mil neck, like a nut. It's 44 mil.
Like a wide
one.
Yes, yes, yes.
That's my favorite neck width on a P bass. It's so ultimately, yes, I'm saying I like it to be harder to play. Does it make any sense? But I just like it.
No, but I know what you mean. It just, it brings out kind of like there's a touch of a struggle. Mm. It seems kind of legit. It maybe harkens to upright a tiny bit. Like there's a little just bit of like, oh, you got to be a little more tenacious, right? Versus the tiny neck where everything's kind of presented to you. And then it's a smaller, more predictable sound versus a P bass where you pull it and the action's maybe a little high and it's like, rah, that split coil's barking back at you.
Yeah,
and, yeah, man, I totally get it. Have you seen, I mean, it's funny, dude. You talk about P basses. So this is a 65.
Oh.
And I bought this from Norman's Rare Guitars before the prices just went
bonk
bananas.
Yeah.
But it's that cool, like, the cool logo. And I mean, it's a huge neck and pretty thin too. But, you know, just that like big 60s, mid 60s neck. L plate. So, you know, although it was CBS era, it was built with all the stuff from pre-CBS era. But check it out, man. I was, you know, active bass guy. And then I got a jazz bass. And that was my into Fender. I got that Antigua bass. Now I'm a Fender guy. Okay, cool. But then Pino, right?
Mm.
You, Hurley.
Hurley.
Lefebvre. Oh,
yeah.
Right? Like all of these people that I admired and looked up to started to play P basses and started to say things like, oh, this is the real thing. I mean, I remember seeing a Sean Hurley interview where he said something like, this is a real man bass. And I thought it was sort of, I remember thinking it was kind of preposterous, but also like it kind of like got in and was like poking at some things inside of me like, oh, gee, am I, you know, so... So I ended up going hard down the P bass thing. And then when I joined Eric Hutchinson's band, this is what I brought. And I only played P for a while. And I was so invested in being one of the guys.
Mm.
Do you know what I
mean? Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I was invested in, and then there was a point at which I made the shift, like you decided to, like, okay, there's a lot of these people playing P basses, and I have a really light touch, and I don't bark like you do on a P bass. I have a very, like, soft approach, and I decided, there was
almost
a day
sensual,
where I decided...
Almost sensually.
But not quite.
Anyway, what did you decide on this day?
There was a day where I said, I gotta be me, at the expense of what my snarky friend is gonna think who loves the P bass. Mm-hmm. I got a couple of friends who were like, oh man, it's so much better when you play a P. But then most people didn't care. And I really just decided, when I am gonna be doing something that feels like me, I want it to be on a jazz.
Yeah.
Because I'm not trying to be Sean Hurley.
Exactly.
I'm not trying to be you. I'm not trying to be Lefebvre. I want to be me.
Yeah.
And still have, of course, a super healthy respect for everyone doing their thing and still play a P bass when it should be a P bass.
Yeah.
Like in session world, you know, I will not take the jazz bass because it's my sound. Like I just did a record a couple weeks ago where it's like I played this bass the most and it's amazing. But whenever I play it, it feels like somebody else's bass.
Oh, that's so interesting. Know? Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, man. And I have never, like, I tried so hard to make the switch.
Love it, yeah.
And whenever I put a jazz bass in my hands, it feels like home.
That's exactly, you that's know? What people should look for, isn't it? That's really, and unfortunately,
yes,
you need to sort of, like, try a lot of basses to find that. But that's the ultimate kind of green light, isn't it? Of finding where your sound is. It's finding what feels like home, no matter what the actual bass is, no matter if it's a jazz bass or P bass or whatever.
Yeah. And I love, dude, I love this idea that you saw all the people playing the foderas and the, and you decided to do something that leaned in a different direction. And obviously tons of people play P basses, but for the stuff you were doing at the time, it was a left turn.
Yeah.
And it, that's so cool. And for me to, in a lesser extent, and I mean, you know, we're talking about Fender basses that everybody plays, but for me too, I saw everyone just like, oh, P bass. There's this P bass club of cool guys. Yeah. And I was like, I can't compete with that.
Exactly.
So I'm going to go back to the thing that feels really like, great to me. And then what happens, what happened for you and what has happened for me too, is people see that commitment to something that may be a little left of center. Mm-hmm. And then they start, then they want to, then they're like, oh, you know, why do you play that? Or like, and then they're influenced by that commitment.
Yeah.
And so for anybody listening, like if you love your, you know, your Schecter, you know, you love your, you know, whatever it is, yeah, right, that you play that maybe isn't always the coolest thing. If you love it, do it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because that, like, your commitment to that thing. Like, dude, I never wanted an Ibanez bass more than after I saw Gary Willis. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like,
it's fascinating, isn't it?
Playing those sound gears. Yeah. I was like, oh.
The depth, yes, of it.
And I never cared about Ibanez before that, really. I mean, I have an Ibanez fretless. It's one from the 80s, but that's for sure. It's partly Sting, but it's for sure Gary too.
Yeah.
You know?
How long have we got you for, dude? Another like two, have you got like 7 minutes? You have to go at 15:15, right?
Yeah, I got 7 minutes.
Dude.
Yeah, for sure.
In the middle of the night, you know, when you're lurking, please, on your phone, or when you're on the toilet, yes, wherever, you know, what are you looking at currently? Yes. Yes. What are you geeking out on currently?
Okay, so I have a thing now because of like playing on records. I have this thing of I want to experience in my life one good example of all of the classics. Oh, like, you know, when I did the 10 basses you have to play before you die video for SBL, like those are all my instruments.
Yeah.
So I have this thing where when I went hard down the vintage road, I was like, okay, I'm going to get a good 50 style P bass with a single coil. I'm going to get a great P bass, just so my thing, and like a great Gibson, like a Thunderbird, even though I'm not playing that thing a lot, but I want, like, I like, there's a list, like, tick, 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 tick off the list. Recently, I have bought some of the most ridiculous things. Can I show
you? Yeah.
One thing? All right. So it went from being, you know, 60s and 70s and vintage stuff to then I crossed this line. This threshold has been crossed into the 80s and 90s, and it is the wild frickin' west, dude. Like I...
Are we talking Steinbergers or...
well, it's on the list, but check this out. Do you know this, babe?
Is that Hamer?
Ready for this?
Oh, I got it.
I was a huge King's X fan.
Oh, yeah.
Doug Pinnick.
Yeah.
A huge Cheap Trick fan, Tom Peterson. So, yeah, man, I have a Hamer 12.
Amazing.
It's preposterous. So the thing with me with basses is I like them to be thumbprint. I like them to have a thing.
Mm.
And then I like to try to adapt. Like when I'm playing a different bass that isn't my Antigua Jazz bass or my beat up Sunburst Jazz bass, I'm then giving... I want the bass to lead the way in a sense where like I'm changing myself because you can't play this like you'd play a jazz bass. So then that's how I'm trying to get inspired to make new sounds is let the instrument inform me how it wants to be played.
Yeah.
Right. So the long answer to your question is right now I'm in 80s zone. I have a NS2, Spectre NS2 that I love. I have a Kubicki Factor.
Oh, yes.
That I really love. You want to see
Ham, dude? Come on.
Oh, I know.
I can remember watching them Stu Ham videos back on. I can remember when Hot Licks, Alan Roth used to run a Hot Licks, the VHSs.
Of course.
Oh, man.
Yes. Check it.
Stu is.
I have a Black Factor.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh.
With the headstock, with the. With the detuner, you know?
I'm actually quite surprised. Maybe it's going to happen. Yeah, it's got that detuner thing, hasn't it? Like, I'm quite surprised that the 80s thing hasn't gone full bore in bass because And like maybe because obviously 80s like aesthetics on from the musical perspective, fashion perspective, that's full on going on. It has been for many years now.
Full on.
But it hasn't really got into musical instruments. And I'm kind of waiting for it. You know, I'm waiting for the headlesses to come back. I'm waiting for the.
Well,
you know, that
I mean,
thing.
In metal, they for sure are.
Really?
In metal. There was a band that I loved. Yeah, there's a Canadian band called Protest the Hero that I loved in the 2000s, and those dudes were playing Steinbergers and stuff. But yeah, I think you'd be surprised, man. I wanted to get an XL2 Steinberger, like a white Steinberger. That's what I want.
Yeah.
And they're $4,000 or $5,000. They're crazy money.
Yeah.
I mean, which is, and that's not $15,000 like an old Fender, but there was a time where you could pick up a Steinberger for $800.
So cheap, yeah. So cheap.
That time is long gone.
Yeah.
And Kubikis are crazy money now too.
Yeah.
These are up in the $3,000 and $4,000 neck of the woods now. So it's coming. So yeah, man. But sorry, I just so tangenty. I want to get a bass hero bass from the 90s. I would love a six-string Ken Smith.
Yeah, me
even
too,
though,
dude.
Like playing it would be silly. Like people would be like, "What is he doing?" but there's just something about that harkens. So for me right now, what it is it's childhood. When I'm looking for stuff, I'm looking to fill that nostalgia thing.
Yeah.
Before that, I was getting a Hofner. I was getting my session bass ducks in a row. Getting the Hofner, right? Getting a really cool late 70s Stingray.
Yeah.
Like just so that when clients or artists say, "Oh, we want that like Rickenbacker," like a bang, I've got a great Rickenbacker that I use. But yeah, man, now it's nostalgia. Now I want the Steinberger. I want the Ken Smith. I want those basses that I went through a period of pretending that I hated them or like, "Oh yeah, that's not cool. Like I'm done with that. I'm ready for them back in my life." What about you, man? What's on your list?
Oh man, too many. I was just thinking then we should have a part two of this because I'm not all out. I've got like a good hour left in me to talk about bass gear, specifically basses. Actually, should we do a part two?
We absolutely could do a part two. We could do this forever.
I want to talk about like Serik. I've got questions about Serik. I've got questions about what's the company that's just building you a base at the minute?
Voren Saku.
I've got questions about this. Mm-hmm. I've got like a bunch of questions.
And Lorita too.
Oh, Lorita, you are such a slut. Look at you. Space slut you.
Oh, I mean, dude, I will say part of it for me, though, is that I really connect with people.
Yeah.
And if I have a great experience, man, I had a phone call with Saku Viore from Voren Saku, and he is such a great dude. And we just chatted it up, man. Yeah. We just chopped it up.
Yeah.
As Doug Wimbish would say, we chopped it up. And we had such a good hang. And I just said to him, you know, he said, "What do you want?" And I said, I want you to make me the most Finnish bass possible. You're from Finland, right? I said, like, and I would love to choose some things, but I want it to have your DNA, your personality, because with something that isn't my Antigua jazz bass, like I say, I'm bending myself to try to get the best thing out of the instrument.
Mm.
I mean, you know.
What would be great? So what would be great is that actually like going through that whole process that you went through when you ordered that bass. Like, what should people be thinking about when they're thinking about ordering a bass? And like, yeah.
Absolutely.
Oh, maybe we should do it. Okay, so like next episode, ordering a custom bass. Let's talk about that.
Oh, dude. And I'm sure you have this too, but I've ordered some stuff over the years. I mean, I ordered my first custom bass from Carvin. Mm-hmm. Then I ordered a custom bass from Zahn, from Joe Zahn. Yeah. So I have tales. I'm sure you do too. I would love to do that.
Let's do it. I'm going in. Right, dude. I'll see you next week. Dudes, listeners,
thank you
for listening. Where should we send them? We're on all of the places, Spotify's and the iTunes.
Yeah, we're everywhere.
We're everywhere. We're like a disease, a bass disease.
Yeah. But a disease that you want to have.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely.
Come on. This is an affliction that you need in your life. This is not.
Absolutely. Well, thanks for listening, guys, and we will catch you next time. Take it easy.
Bye-bye.